Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time, Robert Stone. Stone is most often associated with a crop of writers that emerged in the late 1960s that included our own Ken Kesey and was made famous by Tom Wolfe's The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. The Merry Pranksters, as this group came to be known, embraced a freewheeling literary lifestyle that pushed the boundaries of our culture. When Stone died in January 2015, the New York Times said that he wrote award-winning novels about errant Americans in dangerous circumstances or on existential quests, or both, as commentary on an unruly, wayward nation in the Vietnam era. Stone won the Faulkner Prize for a first novel in 1967 for his book A Hall of Mirrors and the 1975 National Book Award for Dog Soldiers. All in all, he wrote 8 novels, 2 collections of stories, and a memoir. Stone spoke in Portland in 1988, as part of Portland Arts and Lectures at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall.
Thank you very much. Tonight I'm going to read from a prepared text, which is something that I prefer often not to do, but perhaps as a result of my doing so, this will gain in coherence what it lacks in immediacy. This is a response to a statement, the central statement in an essay by William Gass. Gass wrote last spring in Harper's an article called Goodness Knows Nothing of Beauty. The point of that article was the separateness, the mutual distance between morality and effective art. And this is something that I want very much to argue against. So if you will bear with me through the fact that I have to read this, I will console myself with the idea that at least I will be clear about what I have to say. Last spring, the writer and critic William Gass published an article in Harper's Magazine entitled Goodness Knows Nothing of Beauty, which toyed with the proposition that art and moral aspiration were mutually distant. Statements of this view very often seek to replicate in their style the kind of cool and moral elegance they claim for good art, and Mr. Gass's piece is not in this regard exceptional. It is characterized by paradox, alliteration, and a faintly decadent naughtiness suggestive of intense sophistication. In the end, as such pieces often do, it resolves itself solipsistically, that is, it explains itself away in terms of its own moral and aesthetic definitions. But it is interesting to see this old opposition between art and morality appear again, offered by a commentator usually so wise and insightful. To be a preacher is to bring your sense of sin to the front of the church, says Mr. Gass. But to be an artist is to give to every mean and ardent, petty and profound feature of the soul, a glorious, godlike shape. If this means that you get no points in art for good intentions, no one would argue. But I find here echoes of an old romantic antinomian tendency that goes back at least to Nietzsche. It has been argued by people as different as Ortega y Gasset and Oscar Wilde, by Joyce speaking in character as Stephen Dedalus, and by Shaw, during the period when he was writing Major Barbara, and it now appears attempting to invent fascism. In this antinomian vision, morality and art are independent and even in opposition. On the right squats morality. It may be imagined as a neo-Gothic structure, immense, ornate, and sterile. Its self-satisfaction, lack of imagination, and Philistine sentimentality are advertised in its every plane and line. Architecturally, it resembles the Mormon Tabernacle, the one in downtown Salt Lake, not the Hollywood biblical one on Santa Monica Boulevard. It contains drear, echoing silences. And over here, art. Art is nothing but beautiful. Art is like a Black Panther. It has the glamour of the desperado. Art is radical. the appealing cousin of crime. Never a dull moment with art. Morality, in this view, is not only its opposite, but its enemy. This claim of estrangement between morality and art retains its currency for an excellent reason. It's fun. It's agreeable for an artist to imagine himself as a Zarathustran rope dancer, balanced against eternity up in the ozone and thin light, while far below the eunuchs of the brown temple of morality whine platitudes at each other in the incense-ridden noonday darkness. Look before you leap. A stitch in time saves nine. But let us pursue the notion. Let us imagine the novel, for example, freed completely from moral considerations. What would that be like? One thing it might be like is one of the anti-novels of Monsieur Robespierre, written during the 50s and 60s. These are novels without any moral context, but they are similarly without characters, plots, beginnings, or endings. And surely such an exercise in doing without something serves to reinforce the idea of its necessity. Is it possible to postulate the idea of a successful novel about people, or about animals, for that matter? A novel in which the living of life is reflected that exists beyond the signal area of any moral reference points? What about the comic novel? Let's eliminate at the outset the obviously sentimental or political comedies that have a message at the core. Let's take the work of two writers who have written very funny books and who are not usually thought of as kindly humanistic sages, William Burroughs and Evelyn Waugh. Naked Lunch is the prototypical Burroughs novel, and like all the others, it's full of cruelty, not just sadism, but cruelty. The element of sci-fi political satire it contains is sometimes advanced as representing a moral dimension, but I think that's really bogus. The moral element in the work of William Burroughs is in its very humor. In the grimmest imaginable places, in the grammar of drug addiction, in the violence and treachery of the addict's world, Burroughs finds laughter. The laughter itself is a primary moral response. Laughter represents a rebellion against chaos, a rejection of evil, and an affirmation of balance and soundness. One can see this principle at work in the way laughter undercuts super serious attempts at self-consciously wicked sex. I was once given a description of a waterfront S&M joint that presented itself as the meanest saloon on earth. There was a dress code, and patrons were expected to present nothing less than a grim mask of depravity to any observer. There were two house rules, according to my informant. No rugby shirts, and no laughing. Now, we must assume that the people who run places like that know what they're doing. Evelyn Waugh seems to have been lacking in all the qualities we philanthropists find congenial. A bully, a coward, a fascist, a despiser of minorities and the poor, a groveler before the rich and powerful. Waugh was surely one of the worst human beings ever to become a major novelist. But paradoxically, his life and work provide us with a ringing confirmation of the dependence of serious fiction on morality. By borrowing, spuriously or otherwise, it doesn't matter, the certainties of Catholicism, he was able to infuse his best work with the moral center that makes it great. The worldly lives described in the Men at Arms trilogy and Brideshead Revisited are constantly being measured against a rigorous neo-Jansenist Christianity. In these books, the invisible world becomes the real one, and its meanings constitute the truth that underlies the confusion of desires in which the characters struggle. Gass's essay starts by having us ask ourselves whether we'd rescue an infant or a Botticelli painting if we saw both of them being washed out to sea and could only salvage one. The Botticelli's a masterpiece. The baby's only a potential human being. After prescribing us this brisk antinomian exercise, he commences to deflate his own balloon by running it on the thorns of common sense. He refers to the historical struggle against censorship as though this somehow established art's essentially unmoral character, and then admits that each censoring hierarchy was reacting to whatever inadequacies of its moral system that were challenged by the work in question. He reminds us that good books were written by bad people. Then he ends with a truism to the effect that propaganda can't justify bad art or bad writing. There are a few statements in the essay which Gass does not obviate or contradict in the next paragraph, but there is one that stays unforsworn and unqualified in my recollection. He refers to Keats' identification of beauty with truth and vice versa as, quote, a fatuous little motto, unquote. I think this is being unkind to a perfectly nice axiom. And perhaps it is a hasty judgment. Surely we should meditate for a moment on this most appealing sentiment. Is it true? Concerning life, it is a question we cannot finally answer. I think it tends to be true. The explanation at the core of one of nature's mysteries is often edifying. Job cuts through to the substance of it when he questions the magnificence of God. In the end, he learns that God is worshipful, that God's majesty and holiness suffuse the universe. This is what the medieval mystic Julian of Norwich was referring to when she wrote, "All shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well." In terms of Western tradition, it should be true that truth is beauty. Even if you take God out of it, the grimmest principles of existence have their symmetry. All the same, there can be 100 different explanations for things, and every one of them beautiful, and none of them true. But in art, isn't it always true? Aren't truth and beauty very nearly the same? Surely every aesthetic response entails a recognition. What standard do we hold up to art other than things themselves? And what do we require from art, if not a reflection of things, of our lives, in all their variety?
You're listening to a talk by Robert Stone. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project, and we'll be right back with more from Robert Stone. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. It's Robert Stone this time. Now back to his talk from 1988.
We are, in the Western world, what the Muslims call people of a book. Our prototypical book in this culture has been the Bible, regardless of whether or not we are believers or whether we were brought up by believers. After centuries of being Christians and Jews, our context and our perceptions continue to be conditioned by its narratives. It's hard to overestimate the impact of the Bible on our civilization and on our language. The novel came into existence with the rise of a literate mass readership, and the greatest vehicle of mass literacy in the English-speaking world was the King James Bible. It was the great primer. The Bible is unique among religious books in the relationship it defines between God and man, and in the view it takes of human life. The narratives about people in the books of the Bible are thought to mean something. They are thought to be significant. This implies that the corporeal world in which people live is not an illusion to be overcome, or a shadow land reflecting the void, but an instrument of God's will. For centuries, we have been reflecting on peculiar things like why Esau was disinherited and how Isaac could have been ready to sacrifice his son, and asking ourselves, what does this mean? What is at the heart of this strange story? What can I learn from it? How does it bear on my situation? All our philosophies of history descend from the assumptions bequeathed by our scriptures, in that they profess to detect informing principles at the heart of human events. Life matters. Lives matter. Because earthly human history is the arena in which the universe acts out its consciousness of itself, displaying its nature as creation. Human annals become charged. They become an entity, history. History, then, is perceived as a rational process, the unfolding of a design, something with a dynamic to be uncovered. Stories explain the nature of things. Any fictional work of serious intent argues for the significance of its history. A reader holds the characters in judgment, investing sympathy or withholding it, always alert for recognitions, hoping to see his lonely state reflected across time, space, and circumstance. How then can fiction ever be a process independent of morality? To be so, it would have to be composed of something other than language. There is no brown temple where morality resides. There is no high wire above it where the artist whirls in freedom. If there's a wire, it's the wire we're all on out here, the one we live on, with only each other for company. Our having each other is both the good news and the bad. We deceive ourselves, we contemporary people, if we imagine that beneath our feet is a great sound structure, a vast warehouse called civilization, chock-a-block with boring, reliable truths and insights. Around us, there is only deep space. Out here, where we all live with each other, it's mostly impromptu. Right-mindedness is cheap, but goodness? William Gass need not worry about its coming between ourselves and our pleasures. Most journalists who worked in Vietnam during the war were oppressed by the extreme difficulty of translating what they saw into words. It was not necessarily that it was so uniquely horrible. It was only that the brutality and confusion one experienced seemed to lose something when rendered into language. Somehow, in describing the situation so that it could be set up in columns of type, one always seemed to be cleaning it up. I once pondered this process, and a moment of illumination, so it seemed, struck me. We are forever cleaning up our act, not only in describing ourselves, but in imagining ourselves. We project a self-image which is considerably idealized. In our relationships with other people, we conventionalize ourselves so as not to frighten them with our primary process. And just as we individually cultivate an elevated image of ourselves, so we collectively conspire as nations, peoples, as humankind, to create a fictional exemplar of our collective selves, ourselves as we have agreed to imagine ourselves. But this is not the whole story. Though we are only what we are, we have an amazing ability to extend, to transcend the grimmest of circumstances. Moments occur when we amaze each other with acts of hope, acts of courage, which can make one proud to be human. The fact is that we absolutely require the elevated image of ourselves that we indulge. If we did not idealize ourselves, if we only accepted the reality of ourselves, as we are most of the time, we would never be capable of the extensions of ourselves that are required of us. Things are in the saddle, Emerson said, and ride mankind. Whirl is king. Things happen ruthlessly, without mercy. The elemental force of things bears down on us. From one moment to the next, we hardly know what's going on, let alone what it all means. Civilization and its attendant morality are not massive structures. They're more like notions, and sometimes they can seem very distant notions. They can be blown away in a second. In the worst of times, we often look for them in vain. Sometimes the morality to which we publicly subscribe seems so alien to our actual behavior that it seems to emanate from some other sphere. One might call it a fiction, but it's a fiction that we most urgently require. It is much more difficult to act well than we are ready to admit. It can be extremely hard to act sensibly, let alone well. Storytelling is not a luxury to humanity. It's almost as necessary as bread. We cannot imagine ourselves without it because the self is a story. The perception each of us has of his own brief transient passage through things is also a kind of fiction, not because its matter is necessarily untrue, but because we tend to shape it to suit our own needs. We tell ourselves our own stories selectively in order to keep our sense of self intact. As dreams are to waking life, so fiction is to reality. The brain can't function without clearing its circuits during sleep, nor can we contemplate and analyze our situation without living some of the time in the world of imagination, sorting and refining the random promiscuity of events. If the practice of fiction is inextricably linked with concerns of morality, what is there to say about the writer's responsibility? The writer's responsibility, it seems to me, consists in writing well and truly, to use a Hemingway-esque locution. The writer who betrays his calling is that writer who, either for commercial or political reasons, vulgarizes his own perception and his rendering of it. Meretricious writing tries to conventionalize what it describes in order to make it safer and easier to take. It may do this to conform to a political agenda, which is seen as somehow overriding mere literary considerations, or under commercial pressures to appeal to what is seen as the limitations of a mass audience. The effect of conventionalized, vulgarized writing is pernicious. Fiction is an act against loneliness, an appeal to community, a bet on the possibility of spanning the gulf that separates one human being from another. It must understand and illustrate the varieties of the human condition in order to bring more of that condition into the light of conscious insight. It is part of the process which expands human self-knowledge. Meretricious fiction does the opposite of what fiction is supposed to do. The reassurances it offers are superficial and empty. It presents a reality that is limited by its own impoverishment, and as a result, it increases each individual's loneliness and isolation. In the absence of honest storytelling, people are abandoned to the beating of their own hearts. Without it, the burden of life is lonelier than it need be. It must be emphasized that the moral imperative of fiction provides no excuse for smug moralizing, religiosity, or propaganda. On the contrary, it forbids them. Nor does it require that every writer equip his work with some edifying message advertising progress, brotherhood, and light. It does not require a writer to be a good man, only a good wizard. Above all, what I wish to argue is that the laws of both language and art impose choices which are unavoidably moral. The first law of heaven is that nothing is free. This is the law that requires the artist to constantly make decisions, to choose between symmetry or asymmetry, restraint or excess, balance or imbalance. Because this law is ruthlessly self-enforcing in art, the quality of the artist's work will depend on his making the right decisions. The same law operates the scales the blindfolded woman in the courthouse holds. Artistic quality is related to justice. Grammar is related to logic, which is the engine of conscience. Language is always morally weighted. Nothing is free. Again and again, it seems to me, I have come up against that principle. Political situations always attracted me as a subject, and not because I believe that political pathology is necessarily more, quotes, important, unquote, than private suffering. During times of political upheaval, the relationship between external reality and the individual's interior world becomes destabilized. Revolutions, wars, any such upheavals liberate some people from the prison of the self as they invite others to play out their personal dramas on a large stage, on a larger stage. People caught up in things that transcend the personal forever bring their own needs and desires to bear. They make pleasant and unpleasant discoveries about each other and themselves. The elements of drama descend on ordinary people and ordinary lives. I wrote my first book after spending a year in the Deep South that happened to coincide with the first sit-ins and the beginning of the struggle against desegregation and also with the reaction to it. It was written during a period of great change in this country. The first half of the 1960s. It centered on the exploitation of electronic media by the extreme right, a phenomenon which we have not altogether put behind us. A Hall of Mirrors was not strictly a realistic book, but it was, as young writers will, I put every single thing I thought I knew into it. I gave my characters names with the maximum number of letters because I thought that would make them more substantial. And all my quarrels with America went into it. A few years later, working in Vietnam, I found myself witnessing a mistake 10,000 miles long, a mistake on the American scale. Since I believed I had taken America as my subject, I began to write a novel set in Saigon. As it progressed, I realized that the logic of the thing required that everybody make their way back home into the America of the early 70s. The early to mid-70s still seemed to me, in retrospect, like a creepy, evil time. A lot of due bills from the parties of the 60s were coming up for presentation. Dog Soldiers was my reaction to the period. I went to Central America in 1976 to go scuba diving while at work on a different novel and returned several times thereafter. I became acquainted with a few Americans working there. At that time, relatively few people in this country knew where Huehue Tenango was, and Managua, Nicaragua was the title of an old Andrews Sisters song. The Somozas had been running Nicaragua for many years, and they seemed quite secure in their power, at least to my touristic eyes. Everything was quiet there. One day, I even semi-crashed a party at the presidential palace. The presidential palace stood in the middle of what was literally a fallen city. From a distance, downtown Managua looked like a park. It was so green. When one got closer, one could see that the green was that of vegetation growing over the rubble where the center of the city had collapsed on Christmas Eve 1972. The presidential palace stood unscathed in the middle of the destruction. Around it was a kind of free fire zone of scrub jungle where no one was permitted to enter. The palace stood just over the effective mortar distance from the nearest habitation. After this, I made a few more trips to Central America, and I tried to make a point of listening to as many stories as I could. After a while, the stories began to form a pattern that conformed to my sense of Mesoamerica's history. This band of republics between the Andes and the Grijalva seemed placed by its gods in a very fateful situation. They seemed to have drawn the most violent conquistadors and the most fanatical inquisitors. Arriving, the Spaniards had found holy wells of human sacrifice. Their racial and social oppression had always been most severe. The fertile soil of the place seemed to bring forth things to provoke the appetite rather than things to nourish, baubles and rich toys, plantation crops for your sweet tooth or for your head. These lands were yoked to labor-intensive, high-profit products, bananas, of course, and coffee, chocolate, tobacco, chicle, emeralds, marijuana, cocaine. And since my subject was again America and the United States had been involved here for so long, by the time I got back to the States, I had decided to put down the book I was writing and begin a new one, and the new one became my third novel, A Flag for Sunrise. Children of Light, a book about the movies I published in 1986, is also political, in my view. The process that goes into creating American movies is loaded with examples of how America works. People in the film industry who see Children of Light as an attack on movie making apparently fail to see how movie-struck and reverent it really is. I do not claim to know much more about novels than the writing of them, but I cannot imagine one set in the breathing world which lacks any moral valence.
You're listening to a talk by Robert Stone. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project, and we'll be right back with more from Robert Stone. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. It's Robert Stone this time. Now back to his talk from 1988.
In the course of wringing a few novels out of from our fin de siècle late imperial scene, I have never been able to escape my sense of humanity trying with difficulty to raise itself in order not to fail. I insist on disputing William Gass's claim that goodness knows nothing of beauty, nor do I believe that in writing his excellent fiction and lucid criticism, he practices the dehumanized art celebrated years ago by Ortega y Gasset, echoes of which seem to appear in his essay. But just as it's possible to avoid standards of human action in novels about people, it's difficult to avoid politics. But if a novelist openly accepts that his work must necessarily contain moral and political dimensions, what responsibilities does he take on? He assumes, above all, the responsibility to understand. The novel which admits to a political dimension requires a knowledge, legitimately or illegitimately acquired, intuitive or empirical, of the situation which is its subject. Political commitment is not required, although eventually most authors maneuver themselves into a stand. I think the key is to establish the connection between political forces and individual lives. The questions to address are, how do social and political forces condition individual lives? How do the personal qualities of the players condition their political direction? He has to cast the net of his sympathies fairly wide. He should be able to imagine his way into the personas of many different people with different ways of thinking and believing. The aspiring, overtly political novelist might spend a little time every morning meditating on the interior life of General Noriega, a man who actually exists. As far as political satire goes, it should be remembered that the best satire requires a certain subversive sympathy for one subject. The writer must remember the first law of heaven, that nothing is free. Commitment can be useful because it brings a degree of passion to bear, but it's also dangerous. To be the contented partisan of one side or another, one has to sell something. Because so much of serious politics in this century consists of violence, this can be a morally enervating exercise. Moral enervation is bad for writers. Above all, he must not sentimentalize. He must remember that sentimentality is the great enemy of genuine sentiment. I believe that it is impossible for any novelist to find a subject other than the transitory nature of moral perception. The most important thing about people is the difficulty they have in identifying and acting upon the right. The world is full of illusion. We carry nemesis inside us, but we are not excused. Years ago, a whimsical friend of mine made up a little ditty that for me sums up the backwards and forwards, tragical, comical nature of humanity's march. It's a highly moral little ditty, and it may contain the essence of every work of serious literature ever written. The author of this little ditty is here tonight. It went like this. Of offering more than what we can deliver, we have a bad habit, it is true. But we have to offer more than what we can deliver to be able to deliver what we do. I think what happens now is that you ask me questions and I attempt to answer them. The question was, is the mistake then in identifying morality with social conceptions of what's good? And yes, I mean, partly, although that's an interesting question, if I understand it correctly. I mean, if what you mean is the mistake in imagining that you have to follow one political line or another to come through on morality. Yeah, I mean, that's part of it. That's part of the problem, I guess. Would you, Steph? Okay.
Now I swore we wouldn't do this, but Bob and I have been talking about right and wrong and good and evil for as long as I can remember. And it's been wonderful. It's like isometrics. And the reason that I want to ask this question now is because I don't think we're going to get this bunch of people here in Oregon to deal with it again. In terms of right and wrong and good and evil and fair and unfair, I'd like to have you say something about what Mayor Koch is doing with Jesse Jackson.
You can do it, Bob. I can do it all too well. What Mayor Koch is doing with Jesse Jackson is exercising his right of free speech as an American citizen. Apolitical, that's my middle name.
How do you react to the apparent hysterical anti-drug attitude of this country at play?
Well, I don't know how, you know. I'll tell you a couple of things that are part of my reaction to it. Bringing children up in the late 60s and 70s was a very difficult business. I mean, kids were going down right and left. I mean, you really spent a lot of days, or at least we did, really wondering, you know, what was going to come down in terms of drugs. People were scared. They had a right to be scared. They were seeing there was an era in which parents on the one hand abdicated their responsibility, on the other hand all these drugs came through. It was a very difficult and scary business to be a parent in those years, and in a way it still is. I'll tell you what I think about what will have to ultimately happen with cocaine, if that's the main thing that's on everybody's mind now. I think that down the road, after much hemming and hawing and difficulty and speechifying in politics, we're probably going to have to legalize it. Because it is, I really don't, I mean, otherwise we are simply going to have to pretend that we are enforcing laws that we are unable to enforce. This is a drug that is bigger than the Colombian state, bigger than the Bolivian states. These states are not substantial, big enough, strong enough to deal with it. I think that really the best way we can come into contact with habitual drug users is by being the people who administer and sell the drugs, I mean the American state, and then maybe we can get them into therapy. But it seems rather bootless to me that we simply pretend that we're enforcing laws that we are obviously not able to enforce.
A previous speaker, I believe, thought that America is in decline. What do you think of that?
Well, America is going to continue to exist as a country, and you know, decline is a very relative term. In terms of our influence throughout the world, that's already happening. I mean, the country is in decline in that way. That doesn't mean that your life and my life is going to be somehow impoverished. Maybe it will get better. I mean, it really is. It's not. I mean, are we having fun as a major power? I don't. You know, we're not. This is not much fun. You know. So, well, you know. As a former major power, we'll probably have a lot more fun. I mean, the English are really having a wonderful time now as a former major power. On the international stage, I mean, the days when we could call all the shots and so forth are over. That's not necessarily a bad thing for the rest of the world or for us.
How much is Neil Cassidy in Dog Soldiers?
Well, I think my let me see now. Neil Cassidy, Dog Soldiers. I don't write Ramana Clay, so I don't. I mean, he is not lurking beneath the persona of any one of the characters. Also, I have to say that my acquaintance with Neil Cassidy was limited to really two periods of time. So I think the right answer to this question is really not very much.
What did you think of Who'll Stop the Rain?
It's okay. You know, it's not. I think it's not a great movie, nor is it a dreadful movie. I think it has wonderful performances by the actors, and I think that Carol Rice, who directed it, did a pretty good job. I have a lot of dissatisfactions with it. I quit in the course of doing the screenplay, but then I came back on it because I was so impressed by what the actors did. I think it's an okay movie. It has to be judged as a film rather than as a rendering of a novel. And it's not so bad, but it's not great either. It was years after the fact that I not until I read Steve Bach's book about Heaven's Gate, which is called Final Cut, did I realize that it was the victim of a deliberate sabotage by the new regime at United Artists. The head of distribution set out to kill it. In retrospect, that doesn't surprise me now, and I know what I know about movies and the movie business. But I had not realized it that at the time. I wondered why it played for 3 days everywhere in the country, and now I know. It was because the head of distribution went around telling everybody that it was a total turkey, and they would only have to show it for 3 days. And so, but anyway, it's not a bad movie, not a great movie. I superstitious dread seizes me. Not too much. Only the working title, which is Outer Bridge Reach. Outer Bridge Reach is a section of the channel between Staten Island and New Jersey. On the nautical charts, it's marked as Outer Bridge Reach, and it has to do with sailing. She said, the question since children are not reading as much as they used to because they're getting more of their information through television, is there a problem there? And indeed, there is a problem there. The problem is partly with the nature of television and partly with how much of it there is. We have to remember, we really can't lose sight of the fact that there was, this country produced in the late 18th century one of the two literate peasantries that existed in the world. The other was in the lowlands of Scotland. I mean, Americans could read and write before the masses of people in just about every country in the world. I mean, everything that this country is about is based on the fact that this was a country where the man in the street, even back in the end of the 18th century, was often literate. And that we lose our literacy, that we lose... Our country is founded in large measure on language. I mean, these documents, the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, this is the structure of language on which this country rests. We cannot afford to lose our literacy. We cannot afford to lose our conversance with language. It's very dangerous that we become a nation of people ready to turn on a tube and get this stuff thrown at us is not good. It's a bad thing, and we've got to do something about it, and I hope we will. The question, as I understand it, is that since conceptions of art change from time to time and morality is linked with art, conceptions of morality also change from time to time, and consequently, what can we make of this? I'm not sure that conceptions of morality change that much. I really think it's the epiphenomena around morality that changes. I mean, I think we have what one might call a kind of petty morality. Essential morality, I think, is rather a constant. I mean, we don't have a lot of trouble understanding what Cicero, for example, is talking about in his speeches. We don't have a problem relating to the traditions of Western morality. Indeed, we get it from there. We get our morality. The morality we subscribe to is something that we get from the classical world. We get it from the Greeks. We get it from the Bible. So I'm not sure that I agree that standards of morality, other than those epiphenomenal, petty standards of morality like, dress and the deportment of women and so forth, are essential. What I'm saying is that I think substantially morality doesn't change, hasn't changed.
What you were speaking about morality reminded me a lot of what John Gardner wrote in On Moral Fiction. He took a lot of his contemporaries to task in that, people he admired. I wonder if you could take some name the same names, perhaps, from your list of people you admire but think perhaps are not doing as good a job as they might in those terms.
Well, I can't really, because I'm not going to pretend to analyze writers in terms of their adherence to a general moral code. I think the point that I'm really trying to make is I think that good writers tend, whether they want to be or not, they tend to be morally integral, whether they choose to be or otherwise. So it was impossible for me to cite the relative moral sense of one writer over another. I can't do that.
Yeah. Do you think the Reagan administration would have saved the Botticelli or the baby?
I think they probably wouldn't have saved neither of them.
Mr. Stone, I'd like to read your speech from tonight. Will it be published?
It will. It's funny you should ask. Yes, it will be published. It will be published in Harper's in June. I think there is a constant here. I think that in other cultures, there is perhaps even more consciously admitted a connection. In a way, now we are going to the point where there is going to be one culture. I really think the separateness of peoples is going to be over. I don't know what kind of a world that's going to leave us in, but that seems to be where we're going. Yes, I think that in most of the cultures other than Western culture, I think we're somewhat less dynamic and more conservative. In this culture, Western culture, was constantly experiencing a dialectical process where developments were. This is partly good luck, and partly bad luck. But we continued to change. Cultures such as the Islamic, the Chinese, Japanese, Indian, were, for the most part, it seems to me, more conservative. And as a result, I really don't think that their artistic product ever distanced itself very much from the agreed-upon sense of social discipline in the society. I think it is really primarily in the West that art moved at a distance from the general societal norms. I think it's only in the West, really, that we have to ask this question, are art and morality related? I really think that in most of the non-Western cultures, the art, the literature, the poetry, the painting, the sculpture, was a direct expression in a rather formal way of the underlying philosophical basis of that society. Thanks very much.
That was novelist Robert Stone, the award-winning novelist and story writer. He spoke in Portland in 1988. Thanks so much for joining us for Literary Arts, the Archive Project. Robert Stone was our featured writer this time. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. I hope you can join us next time. The Archive Project is a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. We have all our talks online. You can browse through them at literary-arts.org. Spencer Raymond produces The Archive Project for radio. Thanks for joining us.